Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate. The crisis of opioid addiction in this country has reached record levels, and if you wanted to make a short list of root causes of this modern crisis, OxyContin would surely be on it. The drug was aggressively marketed as a solution to chronic pain, despite the fact that many people were getting addicted, despite the fact that the drug's manufacturer, Purdue Pharma, has been the subject of lawsuits and calls for congressional investigations. Until recently, fairly little was known about how the company turned OxyContin into one of the best-selling drugs of its kind. Investigative reporter Harriet Ryan, along with Lisa Jurian and Scott Glove, published a three-part series on OxyContin for the LA Times. And I'm very pleased Harriet Ryan joins us now to discuss it. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
So you start this series by looking at Purdue Pharma's claim that OxyContin will last for 12 hours, which is twice as long as the generic. But what did you find when you actually looked into this claim?
Sure. This is the claim that made so many doctors prescribe OxyContin, made it the best-selling painkiller in the U.S. And what we found was that for many people, the drug doesn't last 12 hours at all. It lasts hours less. It could last 6, 8, 10, 4 hours. And when it wears off early, patients can start going into narcotic withdrawal. And that means experiencing excruciating body aches, pain, and intense craving for more of the drug. And addiction doctors and researchers tell us that that experience of going into withdrawal and then coming back out of it repeatedly creates addiction and can really foster addiction in people who are just trying to take their pain medication, as their doctor said.
Now, how long does it take for someone to become addicted? I mean, it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong from that description you just gave, it's not like if I take OxyContin for the first time, one time, that I am, like, hooked immediately.
Well, you know, it's a complicated issue, addiction, and it's mixed up with a principle called dependence. Anybody who's prescribed an opioid legitimately by their doctor over a period of time will become dependent, meaning they can't just stop.
Right.
It's a function of the drug. What we looked at a lot of research, and we also talked to a lot of people who had become addicted to OxyContin when they were prescribed it for legitimate pain. And what they told us was that initially the drug covered their pain, and for that first 6 or 8 hours, they felt fantastic. And then they would spend the last 6 or 4, 2 hours just intensely focused on when they were going to get to take their next pill.
Hmm.
And they weren't paying attention to their family. They weren't paying attention to work. They're just like, is it time to take the drug? Is it time to take the drug? And over repeated instances of this, it makes you more disposed to become addicted. And so people start doing things like taking pills more often than their doctor said. So then they run out and then they buy them on the street or use other painkillers. And in one case, a man that I talked to, a gym teacher in Florida, he said that it was within a very short period of time that he went from feeling that the drug was wearing off and that he was going into withdrawal to becoming addicted and then a life of crime. You know, that's just one anecdotal case. But it's clear that over time, it does contribute to addiction.
And I do believe you, and this we'll probably get into this a little bit later, that you have situations where it doesn't last 12 hours. It lasts maybe 8 hours or 6 hours, and people will call their doctors, and the doctors will bump up the dosage?
Sure. So Purdue Pharma, the drug company, puts this drug on the market in 1996, and almost immediately they start getting complaints from doctors who are saying, my patients are coming in and saying it's only lasting 6 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours, you know, they want me to prescribe it for them more regularly. That was a problem for Purdue because the main selling point for OxyContin is that it lasts 12 hours, and that's why you should pay hundreds of dollars a bottle or your insurance company could. Now, if the drug didn't last 12 hours, why would anybody be willing to pay that when they could get a generic that lasts, you know, maybe up to 6 hours for a couple dollars a bottle? So Purdue's response to doctors and patients who said it's not lasting 12 hours was to say the problem is not the duration of the drug. The problem is that you're not giving that person enough of the medication. Bump up their dosage. They're on 10 milligrams, moving up to maybe 20. And over time, people are on higher and higher doses. And in some cases, what happens where they continue to go back to their doctors and saying, yes, I'm on a higher dose, but it's still not lasting 12 hours. they'd be bumped up again. And at a certain point, people just become sedated. And it's really hard to complain to your doctor when you're on so much opioid that you're just too sedated to really move out of your chair.
Well, you've mentioned Purdue Pharma many times. Let's talk about this company. When did they realize that all this was happening, that their 12-hour pill was not lasting 12 hours?
So my colleagues and I were able to get access to a bunch of internal corporate records that went back to the early development of OxyContin in the late 80s. And what we found is that in the first clinical trial on real patients, for 50% of the patients, the medication didn't last the full 12 hours. And for almost a third of them, it didn't last 8 hours. So that was evidence right there that it's not lasting 12 hours for many people. They continued to push forward with the development of the drug, and it was approved by the FDA. And once it was on the market, that is when they started getting, many pieces of information from doctors about and patients saying it's not lasting. By 2000, so we're looking at like 4 years on the market, almost 20% of the prescriptions were being written more frequently than 12 hours. So you have 20% of doctors saying like it's not lasting 12 hours for my patients. When these numbers came into Purdue, they saw them as a threat to the business for the reasons I mentioned before, that you know eventually insurance companies were going to say, we're not covering this, just take the generic, this is ridiculous. And so they convened special boot camps for their sales reps about how to talk to doctors and get people, doctors who were prescribing the drug more frequently, back on the 12-hour scheme by bumping up the doses. And so what we see is over time, people that are taking OxyContin at 12-hour doses end up in higher and higher doses of the drug. And our research showed that more than half of people who are prescribed OxyContin, according to a study that we looked at, are taking a level of the drug that is in excess of what the CDC says is safe.
Okay, so, you know, Harriet, how is it possible that by now everyone probably understands and knows that here is a drug that is super addictive, that is not as effective, or I should say, as long-lasting as advertised, and yet it was able to get approved by the FDA? How is that even possible?
You know, it's a great question, and I'd say it's the number one question we get asked about that story. You have to keep in mind that when the drug was approved and going through the process in the early to mid-90s, the FDA didn't have a lot of experience with wide use of painkillers. Before OxyContin, people didn't get round-the-clock opioids for back pain, for joint pain, for arthritis, for migraines. That was very rare. OxyContin changed the world that we live in and opened the doors, really, to the wide use of prescription pills and opioids that we see now. So you have the FDA in 1994, 95, looking at these results. They don't have a ton of experience with opioids. And the standard that they had for establishing the duration of a pill, a medication, how long it lasted, was, does it last X amount of time for half the people that you tried it on? If the answer is yes, then fine. You can say that's the duration of the pill. Now, if it's like maybe a blood pressure medication, sort of like a mild, you know, non-opioid pain reliever, asthma medication, maybe that would be okay. But with an opioid, when there are gaps in coverage, people start going into narcotic withdrawal, and it creates a different level of problem. And there's no indication that the FDA ever considered that was a possible outcome.
Now, one of the things is sort of like the revolving door between the FDA and the industry. Didn't one of the members of the FDA who helped actually help approve OxyContin then go on to work for Purdue?
That's right. One of the medical officers on the case who approved the drug, who was evaluating the evidence, eventually, I think within 2 years, was working for Purdue. And, I mean, that's not unusual for
sure.
The FDA, and it's not unusual for a lot of government agencies when you think about, you know, the SEC or something like that. I mean, industry is able to pay a lot more, and they're looking for people with expertise that government officials have.
Now, I'm speaking with investigative reporter Harriet Ryan of the Los Angeles Times about the three-part series on OxyContin and a drug that is advertised to last 12 hours, but doesn't last 12 hours, but is highly, highly addictive. And it is the product of Purdue Pharma. Hasn't Purdue been sued many times over this 12-hour claim?
Well, Purdue's been sued many times, period, and including they were prosecuted by the U.S. Justice Department, and the company and three executives pleaded guilty in 2007 in federal court to misbranding their drug in an attempt to convince doctors it was less addictive than it was. They've been sued many times by patients, and some of those cases raised the issue of it not lasting 12 hours, but they raised a whole host of issues. And initially, many of those cases were unsuccessful because of a legal doctrine called learned intermediary, which means that between the company and the patient who ultimately took the drug was this learned intermediary, the doctor who advised the patient to take the drug. And so courts threw out a lot of the suits against Purdue on the basis of that legal theory.
Did any of these lawsuits lead to any real changes?
As far as the 12-hour issue, the company is still telling people that it's a 12-hour drug and that they should, it should only be prescribed that way and that it's meant to last that long. If you look at the label, it will tell you, instructs you to take it every 12 hours. So they haven't made any changes to that, and it's limited what they can do. I mean, the FDA approved it as a 12-hour drug. That's the selling point. And it would be hard, I think, at this point for them to come off that claim, and they wouldn't be able to do it without getting new FDA approval.
Mm-hmm. Now, in these lawsuits, did the courts have access to the documents you reviewed showing that Purdue was pushing 12 hours for business reasons?
Well, in some cases, we believe they did. There is a really interesting case in 2004 in West Virginia. The state, as you know, West Virginia has just been decimated by painkiller problems and opioid addiction. And the state sued Purdue in a really small county in southern West Virginia that was just devastated by opioid abuse. And they had a list of problems with the drug. And one of them was that it didn't last 12 hours. And the case made it all the way to, like, the eve of trial. And one of the lawyers that Purdue brought in to sort of argue that the case should be dismissed was Eric Holder, who would go on to become the attorney general. And he was one of the Purdue team that tried to convince the judge to throw out the case. And the judge in this small town looked at the evidence, including the 12-hour claim. And he said, no, I think there's, enough evidence here that a jury should come in and decide whether it's valid or not. And he specifically in his decision talked about the 12-hour claim and said that he believed that there was enough evidence that the drug didn't last that long that it should be evaluated by a jury and that they should be, the ones that said whether Purdue had acted appropriately or not. And after that decision, the company settled and the records were sealed.
Now, one of the things about OxyContin is that it's been trafficked by organized crime. Can you talk about the clinic Lake Medical?
Sure. So you're right. There's legitimate patients with prescriptions who have pain and need their pain to be treated. And the second part of the OxyContin problem in this country is criminal trafficking of it by gang members and drug dealers. So in 2008 in Los Angeles, a felon and an associate set up a fake medical clinic near downtown L.A. And they used dirty doctors, homeless people from Skid Row, and a bunch of sketchy pharmacies across L.A. to procure 1.1 million maximum strength OxyContin pills, which they then distributed across the West Coast. There's evidence that they want these pills were trafficked as far away as Chicago and Washington State. And so you hear that and you're like, that's terrible. Gang members shouldn't do that. Criminals shouldn't do that. These pills ended up in the hands of teenagers and people that died, and it's very dangerous. But what does that have to do with Purdue? Mm-hmm. They sell a legitimate product that's supposed to be prescribed by doctors. So what we found was, again, through internal company records, was that the company had a very robust security apparatus that was tracking, looking for evidence of criminal trafficking of its drug all around the United States. They had investigators and lawyers, and they had field reports and did surveillance operations and were looking, analyzing data. And they had identified this clinic and those pharmacies as a problem. And they had sent employees to these facilities to kind of look around and see what was going on. And in one case, a district manager tried to walk into the clinic, and she immediately realized that it was an organized crime. It was not a clinic. These were not legitimate doctors. She saw groups of men standing around that she said looked like they'd just gotten out of jail. And she went back to the company and said, you know, we need to contact authorities. Something is going on here. This is not on the up and up. The company could see that its pills were just flowing out of this clinic. And instead of alerting law enforcement, they just continued to watch the situation. And they didn't actually come forward until 3 years after this pill mill had gone out of business, and about a month before the perpetrators were scheduled to go on trial. They never cut off the flow of pills from these dirty pharmacies that were ending up in the hands of drug dealers. And in our research, we found that this was not a unique situation at Purdue, that this, in fact, had happened across the country in different areas.
This is incredible that a company that produces and markets heavily a highly addictive product that doesn't work as effectively as it says it does, knows that its product is in the hand of organized crime, tracks it, knows exactly where its pills are going, who's trafficking them, knows who the people are, but doesn't tell the authorities. Isn't there some kind—I mean, how are they not criminally liable for just in that particular instance?
You know, the federal law, under federal law regulating drug manufacturers who make narcotics, they are required to maintain, quote, effective controls, unquote, against the diversion of their product, against their pills from getting into the hands of criminals and addicts. I mean, I think it's a real question in this case whether they were maintaining effective controls against diversion when they could see the enormous volume of very dangerous pills that were gushing out of this shady clinic. The red flags were so red. At the time, the preferred pill for drug dealers was maximum strength OxyContin. It's an 80-milligram pill. And at this clinic, that was all that was being prescribed in terms of OxyContin. Nobody was getting sort of starter-level pills or medium-dose pills. The only thing they were prescribing in terms of OxyContin was 80-milligram pills. There's a legitimate doctor's office would never be only prescribing one strength like that. It's a really good question. I know that they kept track of, or they had a database with more than 1,800 doctors across the country who they suspected were colluding with drug dealers or addicts. And by their own admission, they only turned less than 10% into authorities.
My guest is Harriet Ryan, an investigative journalist with the Los Angeles Times. We are talking about her three-part investigation with Lisa Girian and Scott Glover into OxyContin. We will hear more from Harriet after the break. I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, and I am speaking with Harriet Ryan of the Los Angeles Times. She and two of her colleagues did a three-part series on OxyContin. And Harriet, we have Jean from Queens who actually has a question. Jean, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here. I'm so thrilled to hear about this series of articles because I think it's such a misunderstood topic. But I wanted to ask a question. Have you looked into the regulation of doctors? Because doctors are really between a rock and a hard place because they're actually told that they have to prescribe the long-term medication in order to prescribe oxycodone as well. So they're actually monitored, and they get flagged if they don't prescribe the long-term version because that's supposedly less addictive.
How about that, Harriet? And who's the person who's regulating the doctors in this case? Is it the FDA, or is it the company, Purdue Pharma itself?
Well, the DEA, doctors have DEA licenses to write narcotic prescriptions, and if they don't, if a doctor doesn't have that license, if the DEA pulls that license, they can't. In California, we have a state medical board, just like every other state, and that agency licenses physicians, and they can pull those licenses. We've written about, you know, efforts to crack down on doctors who are colluding with drug dealers and addicts, and we've raised questions about whether these agencies act quickly enough when they receive complaints. To respond to the caller's question, there was a time when the medical community was told and believed that extended release medications, those that last, you know, more than 3-4 hours or so, of painkillers were safer because, you know, it was supposed to be a controlled release, a continuous release where a person wouldn't be able to get a high. I think there's been a real reevaluation of that definitely in the last year. The CDC released guidelines in March and for primary care physicians, and one of their recommendations to doctors was use immediate release medications over extended release medications, that it's better for people to just be taking opioids if they need them at all when they are in pain and not on a round-the-clock basis. That was the recommendation that the CDC came up with.
Now, Harriet, one group of people we haven't talked about and we should have talked about before the break in talking about Purdue Pharma, and that's sales reps. How much influence do Purdue sales reps have on the doctors, and why can't a doctor ignore that sales rep?
Oh, of course a doctor can, and I would say that doctors in 2017 are probably more skeptical of what sales reps, especially from opioid manufacturers, are telling them than they were in the late 90s. But in the late 90s, doctors were getting messages from, you know, educational institutions, continuing medical classes, and sales reps saying, you're not treating pain aggressively enough. Your patients are coming in here and they hurt, and like, you should care about that as much as you care about their blood pressure and their breathing. And so they were really encouraged from all corners, especially the pharmaceutical industry, to treat pain aggressively, meaning prescribe opioids. But I mentioned the CDC guidelines, and the CDC guidelines in March tell doctors that they should not be, or opioids should not be used as your first choice for treating chronic pain, that there's no proof that they work for longer than 3 months, and the risks are so substantial in terms of death and addiction that the CDC has discouraged doctors from using them.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are two things here, I think, that are at work. Well, you tell me if I'm wrong in this. That on the one hand, you've got sales reps who are, like, there are incentives, I would imagine, for the sales reps to push OxyContin. And then on the other side, you've got Purdue recruiting doctors to be speakers, I guess, on behalf of the drug, in order to push the drug. Is that correct? That's also, those two things are part of the mix here, no?
Well, sure. I mean, pharmaceutical sales reps receive commissions in most cases. They get bonuses for their sales. So there was a time when Purdue's reps, you know, if they had a doctor in their district who was, you know, working for a drug dealer or writing prescriptions for addicts, they would actually be making more money from that doctor than they would be from a legitimate doctor. Purdue tried to address the problem by taking those doctors that they had suspicions about and putting them in a separate database where they didn't have to pay commissions on them. But, yes, I mean, Purdue's sales reps are unique and very interesting to me in that, on one hand, they made enormous bonuses off of the writing of these prescriptions. But on another hand, the company was telling them, when you go out there and you see somebody who's acting suspiciously, when you see a doctor who's drunk or high, when you see a waiting room filled with healthy-looking young men, when you see cars in the parking lot without a state license, that might be drug dealing, and you should immediately tell us. So in some ways, Purdue sales reps were the typical sales reps, but in other cases, they're also acting as sort of like law enforcement. And it was just like a really interesting position for many of them to be in.
Well, have the doctors serve as law enforcement, but in a way for the company. But as we discussed when we were talking about Lake Medical, that doesn't necessarily mean that the company is actually going to do anything. And by that, I mean alert the authorities.
No, it doesn't. And I've talked to a number of sales reps before and after our stories came out. And many of them say, look, I was completely in the dark. I knew that that guy was a drug dealer. I knew that doctor was a drug dealer. I could tell from the amount of prescriptions he was writing and from his quote-unquote patients. And I reported him to headquarters, and I thought it was done. I thought they would contact the DEA and put him out of business. It was only, like, years later when I realized, like, I don't think they did anything. He or she's still writing prescriptions. So it was ultimately up to the company's sort of security apparatus to alert the Drug Enforcement Administration. And what our reporting showed was that in many cases, they just didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Harriet Ryan, investigative journalist with the Los Angeles Times. And she and two colleagues have a three-part series looking into OxyContin. I think as many of us are aware that prescriptions are slowing down here in the United States of OxyContin, but Purdue Pharma is a company. It is a profit-driven company. And so what is it doing now that prescriptions are slowing down here in the United States?
You're absolutely right. The prescriptions are cratering here. They're down 40% since 2010. So the owners of Purdue Pharma, it's a family based in Connecticut, the Sacklers, have devised a strategy to potentially replace the billions that they're losing, and that is to go into the developing world and to other places around the globe, China, Brazil, Latin America, and start promoting the wide use of painkillers in those places.
Given everything that we know about OxyContin, which we've been discussing now for a while, is there anybody at Purdue that remotely cares about what they're about to unleash on the world?
Well, you know, we asked to speak with the family that owns Purdue, as well as its global companies, and they declined. And we asked to speak with executives around the world, and they also declined. So I can't really say, you know, what their view of it is. They tell us through statements and spokespeople that they are aware of what happened in the U.S. They are absolutely aware of the terrible epidemic that we have now that their drug launched, and that they are keeping that in mind as they go around the world. Our own reporting found that they are using many of the controversial marketing techniques that they used in the U.S. to make OxyContin the bestseller here in places like China and Brazil and Spain. And in some cases, their representatives are downplaying OxyContin's risk of addiction and telling people and doctors that if you have legitimate pain, you can't become addicted to this medication. Mm-hmm. You don't need to worry about it. And we know in the U.S. that that's just not true.
Mm-hmm. Harriet, we're running out of time, but I want to take another call. Let's go to a caller, Andrew from Brooklyn. You are on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is your question?
It was more of a, well,
or a statement.
From the first time I've prescribed OxyContin, which started in 2008, I was prescribed three a day, because my pain management doctor said that she knew that it didn't last 12 hours. And I even moved to another pain management doctor, Dr. Cruciani and Dr. Portnoy, who were at Beth Israel, which is, I think, Dr. Portnoy, he was actually one of the first doctors who worked with Purdue. But he, too, he prescribed three a day, saying that he knew that the drug didn't have efficacy for 12 hours.
That's so interesting. I'm aware of Dr. Portnoy's role, and it interests me that he prescribed three a day. And I know Dr. Cruciani as well. I think your more experienced pain doctors were able to kind of respond to their patients in a more sophisticated way than family practice doctors who were just like, I don't know, I don't think I can write it three times a day. I might get in trouble. I'm just going to continue to tell the patients to take it every 12 hours.
So, Harriet, in terms of what's happening overseas, I do believe that it was former FDA Commissioner David Kessler who said that Purdue Pharma, or maybe it's this Mundi Pharma. Actually, let's talk about Mundi Pharma, because what are they doing overseas, and how are they working with Purdue to bring OxyContin to the rest of the world?
The Sackler company that sells painkillers in the United States is called Purdue Pharma. Mm-hmm. In other countries in the world, it's called Mundi Pharma. Mm-hmm. It's the same family owns it. You know, they're doing some of the same things they did in the United States. They're convincing doctors that their fear of prescribing narcotics is unfounded. They call this opiophobia, and, you know, sales of OxyContin in the developing world and elsewhere depend on doctors believing these drugs are safe. They're encouraging patients to seek aggressive treatment for common painful conditions like back pain. They're running these chronic pain awareness campaigns featuring celebrities in Spain and Brazil saying, don't endure your pain, go talk to your doctor. And they're even offering sort of like discounts for people to be able to afford the pills, for example, in Brazil. And these are similar things that they did in the U.S. in the late 90s.
And we're not talking about like overwhelming pain or the pain of people who have terminal illnesses, people who might have terminal cancer, where, you know, easing their transition and their end of life make it as pain-free as possible. We're talking about, I love this euphemism, pain management, because what was once prescribed for really serious pain sounds to me like is being prescribed for what under normal circumstances, quote unquote normal circumstances, would be just sort of manageable pain that you could, you know, solve or cure or ameliorate with something less narcotic, you know, not to advertise, but like Aleve or aspirin or Advil or something like that.
Yeah, you make an excellent point. I mean, no one disputes that people who have cancer, people that have end-of-life conditions such as HIV, should be treated with opioids. And no one disputes that people who have trauma, who are in a car accident or a broken mm-hmm. bone, should receive opioids for a short period of time. But our leading health experts in the U.S. say that there's just no evidence opioids work long-term. So even if they were great treatment, even if they were completely safe treatment for something like lumbar pain, there's just no proof, scientific proof, that after 3 months they work. The body and the brain sort of readjust to opioids. It's called neuroplasticity. And because there's no proof that they work and the downsides are so severe, the leading minds in the U.S. are saying we need to stay away from these drugs and we're over-prescribing them. So, but the issue with opioid manufacturers like Purdue is like chronic pain, lumbar pain, is where they make their money. Hmm. The cancer and hospice care is very small compared with the huge market for people with joint pain and backaches, and that's where you really make your money.
Uh-huh. You know, Harriet, you participated in a Reddit AMA back in December about this story, and many people seem quite frustrated or outright angry about the difficulty of getting opiates for genuine pain problems and seem to think that the stories like yours were demonizing people who take opiates and doctors who prescribe them. Do you get similar feedback when reporting this story?
Absolutely, and what I tell people is that chronic pain is a terrible problem in the United States and elsewhere. It just is. And people that get up every day who have debilitating conditions and manage to get to work, take care of their children, provide for their families, amaze me with their courage. That's not the issue. The issue is whether the drug companies are marketing their products in a fair and accurate way, and whether there is any evidence that scientific evidence that shows that long-term, these are good for patients and good for society. And I'm not saying this. It's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is saying there's no evidence these drugs work long-term.
I've been speaking with Harriet Ryan, an investigative journalist with the Los Angeles Times, about her three-part investigation with Lisa Jirian and Scott Glover into OxyContin. Thank you so much, Harriet, for joining us today.
It was great to be here.